Well, thank you all for inviting me today. Thanks so much, Kleber, who has been a wonderful companion the 10 months that I've been here in the Ministerial Fellowship of St. Louis, and it's been great being around, and I hope to be back some of these days to see you all again. I have to confess that I, at one time, was indispensable. My indispensability snuck up on me like that proverbial lobster pot rising 1 degree at a time. It finally hit me one day when I was in the middle of a conference call. I had had a surgical procedure that morning, and I couldn't get out of bed. So I arranged to make the conference call to keep up with my responsibilities. Sometime during the call, flat on my back and bleeding, it occurred to me, this is absurd. That's when I remembered the saying from Charles de Gaulle in the Order of Service this morning, the graveyards are full of indispensable people. During that bedridden conference call, I realized that I was indeed indispensable and that indispensability is an absurd fiction, and that it was killing me. Now, you perhaps agree with me that a little bit of self-awareness is a very dangerous thing. Because as I lay in bed, drugged and bleeding, conducting my indispensable business, I couldn't figure out how to stop being indispensable. Perhaps you've read the statistics. Every year in the U.S., the work year increases by 1 day. The average American has 16 hours of leisure a week after the job and the dishes and what have you. Working hours are longer today than they have been in any time since the 1920s. Cornell professor James Moss calls the U.S. a nation of walking zombies and estimates that the average American has a 2-hour-per-day sleep deficit. Moss estimates that being sleepy causes 1,500 fatal accidents every year and costs the economy $150 billion. We are so indispensable that we can't even sleep. But we're losing more than just our sleep. I must admit that I dealt with my despair at being indispensable in some very unhealthy ways. And my revelation of indispensability's absurdity, my glimmer of self-awareness, didn't stop me from continuing down that path for a couple more years. I just didn't know how to stop. Were my story unique, I wouldn't bother telling it to you, but unfortunately, it's not novel. I know that several of you here today are dying of indispensability. You may be in stage 1 or stage 4, but you've got the disease. Now, if my story were also one of sudden dramatic conversion, going to the altar and realizing and changing it, or if it were one of calamitous disaster, waking up on the floor or in the ditch, that wouldn't be surprising. But my situation actually, I think, was a little bit more insidious and dangerous than that. Because in addition to the unhealthy ways that I dealt with the situation, I also exercised and I meditated and I saw therapists and I went to the physician and I took antidepressants and I bought heaps and loads of self-help books. I prayed and I journaled and I reached out to friends. I was proactive in my collapse. I did everything you're supposed to do. Still, eventually, I ended up certified as legally insane, and went to an institution. That's how indispensable I was. I ended up on a road of 12-step programs and therapists and more antidepressants. Again, if my story were unique, I wouldn't be telling you, but I suspect that some of you, or at least someone you love, is also indispensable. To build a bit on the point I perhaps made with the kids this morning about definitions and words, Jesuit priest Anthony DeMello tells the story of an old farmer who lived on the border between Finland and Russia. The old farmer had always thought he lived in Russia until one day some Russian and Finnish officials came to inform him that his house was precisely on the border between Finland and Russia. The old farmer could choose which nation he wanted to be a citizen of. The old farmer thought and thought. He thought so long that the officials were getting a little bit peeved. Eventually, the old farmer said, "Though I love Mother Russia with all my heart and have lived in Russia all my life, I choose to have my house in Finland." And with that, he broke down crying. The Russian officials were amazed. "The choice is yours," the officials said, "but why, when it obviously makes you so unhappy, have you chosen to live in Finland?" "I love Mother Russia," the old man replied, "but I don't think I can survive another Russian winter." This anecdote points out the absurdity of definitions, but it also says we live in our definitions. The Greek Stoic philosopher Epictetus once said, "People are not disturbed by things, but the view they take of things." And that's a true statement. Though when he read the statement by Epictetus, behavioral psychologist Herb Kimmel responded, "Yes, but what about bullets?" And our problem, our human dilemma, is that both of those statements are true. Continuously in philosophy, psychology, and religion, we hear that it is our view of things that affects our reality. Stoic philosophy is built on the idea, as is the Buddhist concept of non-attachment, and the Taoist idea that we need to allow water to roll downhill. Our attitudes cause our suffering, but also they don't. It's a tough call, especially when you yourself are in one of life's little pickles. I spent time as a chaplain in a hospital where the top floor was called palliative care. That is, patients went to that floor when another medical procedure held very little hope. Patients on the palliative care floor were what is termed in the business actively dying. Actively dying patients seldom have illusions about what it is that's happening to them, but they have very widely varying attitudes about their attitude about what is happening to them. And it really has very little to do with religious belief, interestingly enough. The variation is what people choose as a definition of death and their own dying. I've held hands with those weeping and hyperventilating as they face the inevitability of their mortality, and I've held the hands of those smiling and beatific as they face their end. Same reality, but some people fear a Russian winter, and some choose to live in Finland. Epictetus put his finger on that fact. People are not disturbed by things, but the view they take of things. And Stoic philosophy goes to town on that idea. Heraclitus was another one. Buddhism goes to town on that idea. What's called the New Thought movement that gave us Christian Science and the Unity churches, they all go to town on that idea. And the lucrative repackaging of that idea will make someone $1 million this year in the self-help industry, I guarantee you. But can such thinking save us from becoming indispensable? And what about bullets? As Hamlet says, ah, there's the rub. What about things like bullets? Because they fly around in foreign nations and in airports and in the poorer parts of our cities and even in our schools and fast food joints. Bullets. I certainly wish that a good attitude and a positive definition of the world would stop a flying bullet, but it doesn't. Bullets fly, and dying sometimes does hurt, no matter whether we choose to live in Finland or Russia, or the sunny side of life, as the old saying goes. Now, I admit that I am being unfair to Stoic philosophy and Buddhism and Taoism, which have considerably more depth than the latest New Age phenomenon. Taoists and Buddhists know about bullets and bombs. Stoic philosophers knew that definitions and attitudes do not stop arrows or disease or old age. Epictetus was a Roman slave, after all, exiled from his home country. Stoicism and Taoism and Buddhism, as a matter of fact, do quite well on palliative care floors, wherever those might be, because we are all actively dying, no matter what our attitude is about that. And here I'll come back to my own story. I am an American through and through. And that means that when I get in a spot, I do something about it. So when my midlife crisis, or whatever it was that was driving me insane, began to hurt a little too much, I did something. Because I believe in pulling myself up by my own bootstraps, and because I didn't want to hurt. And my logic went, since I was indispensable, I had to get up and get on with it by any means necessary. Since my midlife meltdown brought me to the ministry, as you may have surmised, instead of skydiving or expensive sports cars, you have probably decided or thought that religion has played a somewhat central role in my life. And I do say religion, not spirituality, as I got a little tired of the Barnes & Noble section on spirituality. And I will use the term salvation advisedly, of course, because for at least us Unitarian Universalists, that word usually makes us very tired. As I said earlier, during my breakdown, I did everything right. I reached out to friends and professionals. I bought armloads of self-help books and armloads of books on Hinduism and Taoism and Buddhism and reinterpretations of Christianity and just about anything else in the self-help section or the religion section of Barnes & Noble. I took to heart the sentiment behind the philosophy, people are not disturbed by things, but the view they take of things. Unfortunately, nothing for me stopped the bullets. For me, it came down to the moment that the German poet Rilke describes when looking at a great piece of sculpture. Rilke says, "Here there is no place that does not see you. You must change your life." And so, that's what I did. There's a Taoist story that illustrates my next point. Once upon a time in ancient China, the emperor was in his study looking over volumes of diplomatic documents. He was finding it hard to concentrate, so he called in the prime minister. That's the character today in both stories. When the minister arrived, he saw that the emperor was pacing back and forth and looking very irritable. The emperor said, "I wish to focus on the affairs of state, but my mind is unsettled and agitated. I have become indispensable. When I feel like this, I need something I can look at to help me regain tranquility. Have the best artist in the land create a painting for me, and the title will be True Tranquility." "As you wish, Your Majesty." And so the minister summoned three artists that were competing at the top of their game. He asked all three of them to paint a painting called True Tranquility, and the emperor would choose his favorite. When the work was done, the emperor went into the studio with the ministers to look at the paintings. The first painting they looked at depicted a placid lake surrounded by mountains. It was a beautiful scene. The surface of the lake seemed perfectly still and conveyed a peaceful feeling. And the emperor said, "That's beautiful." The second painting showed a snowscape. It evoked the silence after a huge snowfall, a deep silence that went beyond the mere lack of noise because the snowbanks were so huge they absorbed all sound. Both the minister and the emperor looked at it, and they nodded. "Very insightful," said the emperor. They looked at the third painting, which featured a tall, tumultuous waterfall. "I'm sorry, Your Majesty," said the prime minister. "It looks like this artist did not understand my instructions to paint a scene of tranquility and serenity. Let me throw this one away, and you can pick between the other two." He reached for the painting, but you're ahead of me on this, right? The emperor stopped him and said, "No, wait." He looked at the painting and said, "That's the one for me." "Why?" said the clueless, as always, prime minister. "This doesn't look like tranquility. I don't understand." "The waterfall is not the important thing in the painting," the emperor said. "Look at it again." So the prime minister looked very, very hard and carefully, and he saw a little tree by the huge waterfall. On one of the branches of the tree, there was a nest, and a teeny little thing inside the nest was a sleeping bird. "See how the bird is able to relax and rest, even though the deafening torrent is so close to it?" the emperor said. "That has a profound message of quietness. The external conditions have no power to irritate or disturb the bird. That's the painting I will call true tranquility." And indeed, of course, it is. The trick is getting there. Could I have saved myself somewhere along the line, or did I have to end up in an institution to figure out my life? I still don't know. I have done what I've done, and you're going to do what you're going to do, and I just want to share that with you. Perception, reality, illusion, error, bullets, happiness, a still pool is disturbed by a stone. That's why the Taoists don't like the still placid pool. Throw in a rock, it's not still. And guess what? Huge snowbanks melt. It is the tranquility within. The feeling of indispensability may spring for us humans from wishful thinking, that the world cannot run without us, and that therefore maybe, just maybe, we are so indispensable, we're immortal. But all the evidence points to the contrary. For some reason, I was so thick that I had to go and get yet another graduate degree, this one in ministry, to figure out what I hope some people figure out without so much time and energy and borrowing money. And that is that sometimes we're helpless. And we're far more helpless more often than we are indispensable. The graveyards are full of indispensable people. What we have is a short time on the earth to spend wisely and happily. Was the old farmer warmer because he lived in Finland instead of Russia? Oh, maybe he was because he thought he was. Or maybe he discovered that Finnish winters are just as bad. Or maybe the weather really was colder or warmer that next winter, and he considered the accident part of his decision. Whatever the outcome, reality did not change. The old farmer actually lived on the border between, as do we all. Amen.